You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, dating apps are reporting an increase in users and messages. We'll find out how the pandemic has changed dating, both virtual and in person, and you can share your story. Now, the major party vice presidential candidates, Democratic Senator Kamala Harris and Republican Vice President Mike Pence, squared off in their only debate that they'll have ahead of the election. For an hour and a half, the candidates argued over the future of taxes, climate change and jobs tied to fracking, and racial bias in law enforcement. Throughout the debate, the COVID-19 pandemic took center stage as both candidates criticized the other side for lacking a substantial plan to deal with the crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What were some of your takeaways from last night's vice presidential debate? Do these debates matter to you? Who do you think won if you call winners on these? Do you want to see more presidential debates? Some of those are up in the air right now. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Andra Gillespie is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute at Emory University. Andra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what are some of your basic takeaways from last night's debate, Andra?
Each of the candidates had two challenges, so they were very distinct. Because he is the incumbent, Vice President Pence didn't have to prove that he could take over for President Trump in the same way that Senator Harris had to. So, the stakes were high for her. If she made a major misstep or a major gaffe, it could actually help diminish confidence in the overall ticket and call into question Joe Biden's judgment. I think on that regard, she performed well. I think people can tell that she was ready and prepared and that, she needed to take over, that she could be ready on day one. Vice President Pence had to defend the Trump record. And in particular, he had to defend it after a week of really bad news. The first, President Trump's horrible debate performance last week, and then the COVID diagnosis. So he was on the defensive, and he did, provide a defense of the Trump administration that would likely appeal to his base. But I don't know that if he was able to convince other people who have been really dissatisfied with what they've seen from the Trump administration, particularly in the last week.
Yeah, big picture. It seems like something really big or weird would have to happen in a running mate debate to really move the needle on the election, right? It's kind of uncommon that this is going to be a debate that really swings things one way or another. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, so in general, vice presidential candidates aren't the draw to the ticket. So people vote on who the presidential nominee is and not who the vice presidential nominee is. I think the stakes were higher this year because both of the vice presidential nominees are younger than their running mates, and these running mates are the oldest candidates in history. So, there is some concern about that and the concern about whether or not they would need to take over. And in that respect, they might actually be influential on the overall vote in ways that vice presidential candidates historically are not. But at the end of the day, people are voting for Joe Biden and Donald Trump. They're not really voting for Kamala Harris and Mike Pence.
And this debate happened in the midst of not just COVID-19, but in the midst of this White House outbreak that seems to be getting wider and wider. Did that change the tone or the feel of the debate? I mean, apart from, I guess, the plexiglass?
Aside from the plexiglass, I think it was the first set of questions, particularly when Vice President Pence didn't really respond to the question that about why America has had a disproportionate number of cases and a disproportionate number of deaths. His supporters will likely not be deterred by the answer that he gave. But I think for a lot of people who were planning on voting for Joe Biden, there was nothing in that answer that was particularly comforting. In fact, it just looked really evasive.
I want to give a listen to both candidates talking about COVID-19 a little bit. Let's start with the challenger, Senator Harris.
They knew what was happening and they didn't tell you. Can you imagine if you knew on January 28th as opposed to March 13th? What they knew, what you might have done to prepare.
And then here's a listen to Vice President Pence.
The reality is, when you look at the Biden plan, it reads an awful lot like what President Trump and I and our task force have been doing every step of the way. I mean, quite frankly, when I look at their plan that talks about advancing testing, creating new PPE, developing a vaccine, it looks a little bit like plagiarism, which is something Joe Biden knows a little bit about.
So this COVID-19 outbreak, a huge issue, of course, for the country. Polling suggests that people don't favor President Trump on the COVID-19 issue. Do you think either side made a compelling case? You were starting to touch on this already, Andra, one way or the other on COVID-19 here.
What I'm not sure about, and we have to see it, is for people who are undecided whether or not the arguments last night actually swayed them. I don't think that they will actually be particularly persuasive in that particular regard for people who haven't quite made up their minds yet about who they're going to vote for or what they think about the COVID response. At the end of the day, I think that both of the nominees did what they were supposed to do in supporting their partner. At the end of the day, we're going to come back and vote for the people who are at the top of the ticket, not the people who are on stage last night.
We were talking about debates, last night's vice presidential candidate debate in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions and your questions. Andra Gillespie is with us from Emory University. Let's go to a caller now. Marsha is with us in Madison. Marsha, hi.
Hi. I watched last night, and then we had watched the previous one with Biden-Trump, and so frustrating that we didn't watch it all. And then they talked about the next day taking care of, respecting each other's time and it was just terrible. So anyway, I don't know why they can't get one moderator who can handle both of them. Two, why aren't they turning off speakers of the one who just continues to talk? It's getting to the point where I don't want to watch it, listen to it anymore, watch it, whatever. I mean, it's just... what is the solution there? There is no respect anymore.
Marsha, thanks a lot for the call. Andra, Marsha saying it looks like debate rules were made to be broken, and she'd like to see something done about that.
I understand her frustration. I think that there are a couple of things that are at play. First, it's actually a time-honored strategy in political debates for candidates to attempt to try to run over time to try to get that last spot in. There are some people who have made the argument, I don't know if I agree with it, that it shows that you have so many ideas that you can't get it all in the minute or the 2 minutes that you're allotted. So I wasn't surprised that people ran over time. I mean, I think we should note that neither Pence nor Harris, broke the rules in the same egregious way that we saw it happen last week. And even with the interruptions, and there were interruptions, there weren't nearly the number of interruptions that we saw in the first presidential debate. I think that the subject of whether or not the moderator should cut off the mic is a touchy subject, right? Because especially when you're dealing with incumbents, you are cutting off the mic of the president or the vice president of the United States. And so somebody needs to be able to do it. And you would hope that somebody who's in a position of leadership also knows how to follow and to be respectful of rules and to model good citizenship in that way. It's actually really hard to do when you're actually in the situation. So in some ways, I would actually, not having moderated a political debate before, but having moderated many forums in my administrative role as director of JWJI, I know that when a speaker wants to talk, really it's hard to stop them, even when you're gesturing and doing everything to kind of shut them up. So you have to come up with other ways to try to finesse it, which is why I think you heard Susan Page saying, thank you, Mr. Vice President, a lot in the attempt to very suddenly tell him to shut up. And he just would not take the, he wasn't going to take the bait.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Lodi. John, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to share my thoughts on last night. I'm a moderate that by very slim margin voted for Trump last time around. And I'm just having trouble again this time making up my mind because I just can't believe that the Democrats, which I've always voted prior to this last election, can't put together a ticket. I'm just very surprised at it. I think Kamala Harris is not the least bit qualified, and Joe's on his way out. So it's unfortunate. I think she got killed last night.
John, thanks for the call. So he didn't support Senator Harris's performance last night. I think she's unqualified, Andra.
Well, I mean, I respect his decision. I mean, I think a lot of it was just stating opinion. If we look at the ways that Senator Harris could be considered qualified for the job, and most of the time we look at that based on prior experience, she certainly has held the requisite jobs that would tend to qualify somebody for being president or vice president of the United States. Historically, we've often looked at senators and governors, the fact that she's a senator, the fact that she's an attorney general of a state. The fact that she's been a prosecutor, the fact that she's held elective office before, you know, some people would look at it as a qualification. I understand why some people disagree, or why some people may disagree with her policies and the things that she's championed in those positions. And I think in terms of the debate, one, I wait to see the scientific polls that come out that will say sort of who won that particular debate. But I think it's also important to go back, and I would encourage, you know, all of your listeners to go back and not just listen to the substance of the comments about what they say, but to also screen everything through the fact checker, because, you know, both candidates said things that were misleading. Some candidates said things that were outright untruthful. And so I think it's important to not just take what people are saying at face value, but to interrogate it through legitimate media sources. And so I think here, legacy mainstream media are actually really important here, because they have editorial processes. And you'll see sort of like what they said that was true and what they said that kind of, you know, leaves a little bit more to be desired.
Thanks for that call. We're recapping last night's vice presidential debate with Andra Gillespie, associate professor of political science at Emory University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think about last night's debate? Did it matter to you one way or another in making up your own mind? Do you want to see more presidential debates? It's kind of up in the air right now. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about last night's vice presidential debate. Andra Gillespie is with us, associate professor of political science and director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute at Emory University. You can join in still with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Go back to your calls now. Bree is with us in Waukesha. Bree, hello.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Bree?
I had watched, PBS had been, is my go-to choice for watching these debates. And they had a panel of likely voters that came on after for a little bit of analysis. And it listening to a lot of them speak, it kind of just reminded me, it feels like we're living in two different realities. Some of the panelists who said that they were Trump supporters had said, you know, that they thought it was really fair. They thought that Biden was, you know, his aggressiveness was perfectly fine, or that he wasn't getting enough time, actually. And it just shocks me. It just seems like we're living in two different sets of how we're watching this. And I don't know if that's because of political bias or if it's just generally how we're seeing the world completely differently.
Bree,
but it really did kind of disturb me.
Bree, thanks a lot for the call. Andra, are we living in kind of two separate political realities?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, a lot of it has to do with political polarization and then also how we process information. So, you know, we're living in extremely polarized times. And that polarization is driven by a lot of things. One, parties that used to be big tents that used to have their own ideological diversity, so they'd have conservatives and liberals kind of in the same spaces in both parties. That's no longer really the case. The liberals have flocked to the Democratic Party and conservatives have flocked to the Republican Party. This is largely true for whites. It's less true for people of color for reasons having to do with race and perceptions of racism and sort of the stances on race that the parties have taken. But what that means is that people don't interact with each other and they don't really have – there isn't a middle, so there aren't people to really be a bridge to the other side. The other thing that's happening is this thing that my colleague Alan Abramowitz calls negative partisanship. So sometimes you define your own partisanship by knowing that don't agree with the other side. So I am this because I am not that. And that manifests itself in a lot of ways. And one of the ways that it happens is in survey questions, we ask whether or not people think that folks in the opposing party are just, you know, well-intentioned people whose ideas differ from mine or people whose ideas are dangerous. And we've othered our partisan opponents in ways that I think are actually really troubling and really damaging. And that also increases the odds of one-upsmanship. So you can't concede that the other side might have a point or might be right on a particular issue, right, if the consequences and stakes are so high that, like, power or, you know, something along those lines. So I think that, you know, I think I appreciate that you care about this. So I think that you and others who are like-minded are going to have to model better behavior of learning to get to know deeply people whose views are opposing to yours, and who are willing to respect other ideas, and people who are willing to look at facts objectively, and not just cherry pick information that's going to confirm what they already believe. You know, unfortunately, like from television, we can see that when people encounter discordant facts, they tend to double down on what they already believe. They don't necessarily see that as an opportunity for reflection and perhaps to be persuaded.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Tony now in Ironwood, Michigan. Tony, hi.
Well, hi. You know, I said a couple of weeks ago, it occurred to me that it would be a miracle if either of these men won the presidency. I think of them as both so badly flawed. You know, Trump, for all his horrible tweets, I think what he's done is not necessarily so bad, what he actually does, but what he says is horrible. And Biden, I don't know how to size him up. He feels his son Hunter did nothing wrong. I would say he possibly did nothing illegal, okay? But this whole idea of politicians having a right to cash in, and you know, you see so many people get into politics and they end up being quite wealthy. And so I consider neither one of them to be worthy of president, to tell you
Tony,
the truth.
Thanks a lot for the call. Now, that takes me back to 2016, Andra, when there was a substantial constituency that really didn't like either of the candidates. Do you feel like that's as big a group in the United States this time around?
So if we look at favorability ratings, and Joe Biden's favorability certainly, you know, takes a hit over the course of the campaign as a result of negative campaigning. But Joe Biden isn't in the same type of position as of being disliked in the same way that Hillary Clinton was. Why Hillary Clinton was so disliked is something that a lot of people are going to speculate on, particularly in thinking about the role of gender and perhaps fomenting that. So Joe Biden is in a different position. There are people who fundamentally disagree with him, right? They don't agree with his policies. They don't agree with his record of service. There are people who, you know, would be predisposed to not support him because they don't share his partisan convictions or they don't share his views on certain key issues. And I think that that's to be expected. I think what voters are going to have to, you know, reckon with, and it's a decision that each person is going to have to make, is what are their values, how well they think the incumbent administration has performed, and who are they going to be comfortable casting a ballot with? Under whose administration are you going to want to live under for the next 4 years? So, you know, I think each person has to make their decision, and we hope to give them to give them enough information so that they can make informed choices.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Andra Gillespie from Emory University, looking at last night's debate. Let's go back to our callers now. Emily with us in Green Bay. Emily, hello.
Hello. Yes, I would just like to say that I think Senator Harris is very much qualified for the office of vice president. She was the attorney general for the state of California. She was a prosecutor. She's now a senator, and she's on several committees through the Senate. And I think she's more qualified than Donald Trump was.
Emily, thanks a lot for the call. That was maybe a plus and a minus for candidate Donald Trump, his lack of government experience. Andra, how do you think the qualification issue stacks up for voters?
I think that some of this is affect and sort of partisanship and, you know, other personal proclivities. I also think that, you know, a lot of the discussion that we have, and I think we're going to have a national reckoning about this going forward, is what is our relationship with expertise and with elites. So sometimes there are people who feel that, you know, elites, you know, people who are beltway insiders, cultural elite college professors like me, you know, tend to condescend to regular folks. And so I think Donald Trump, in part, was able to capitalize on that frustration. But I think we have to have a conversation about what expertise looks like in different contexts and who we should trust to be able to make decisions and who we should entrust certain decision-making capacities too. You know, I will say this, you know, somebody who has a PhD, my PhD is all well and good, but if I think that I can learn to rewire, like, my house by watching some videos, I hope that an electrician, like, laughs in my face and calls me, right, because I'm probably just setting my house on fire. And so there is expertise in lots of different places, and we should take advantage of it. I think we should understand that sometimes people who are professional bureaucrats or people who are professional politicians have gained some skills along the way. And that's hard to do when you're in a democracy where everybody does have a say, and we want to honor that. But I think it's also important to sort of, you know, understand that there are people who've spent their lives and their careers studying these issues and knowing the ins and outs of details. And, you know, perhaps they would deserve the same type of deference that I would give to my electrician or to my mechanic who can fix my car in ways that I can't.
I want to take just our last minute or so for a look at possible future presidential debates. Supposed to be two more. Now, the debate commission says, hold on, the president has a contagious disease. We're going to make the next one an online, a virtual debate. Now, the president says, nope, I'm out. This story's been changing through the day. What does it mean if we don't have one or both of those debates now, Andra?
Well, sort of in perspective, people tend to learn more from the first debate than they do from the later debates. And debates are useful for people who don't have a whole lot of information, who haven't been following the contest. This is their introduction. And so if we think about that as the first impression for some candidates who were just, for some voters who were just turning into the 2019 cycle or 2020 cycle, we got what we got, right? And so President Trump is taking a risk by kind of making that at least the sort of closing argument for now, right? He wants to do it with rallies, and we'll see whether or not people pay attention there. I think there's also the issue of what does it mean that a president who is presumably contagious refuses to, like, you know, be willing to undertake sort of having a virtual debate where he can't be in the same room with other people, right? This speaks to the things that we've been talking about over the last couple of days about some of the decisions that he made, from whether it was the drive around Walter Reed or taking off his mask when he got back to the White House, right? It's sending really important optics about sort of the president's empathy and about his judgment at this particular time.
Andra, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute at Emory University. She joined us today to talk about last night's vice presidential debate. Coming up, the pandemic has meant isolation for many, especially single people. We'll talk to two experts about what dating looks like right now, who's doing it, what it looks like, and what to consider if you're looking to try it out right now. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, what happens when two women whose past connects them to those enslaved and those who owned slaves come together to tackle their shared history? Hear that story today at 6 on 1A+. Now, going on dates can be difficult in normal times, but the pandemic has made things even more complicated. Despite that, many people are choosing to try to make it happen anyway, maybe more deliberately and with more safety precautions than before, using online apps, online dates, even some in-person meetups. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been doing any form of dating in the last few months, or someone you know, perhaps? Did you join an app for the first time? If you're a frequent user of the apps, have you noticed changes in how people interact? Even if you just joined up and haven't gone on dates or anything, like to hear your experience, call on 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Skylar Wang is a PhD candidate who studies the sociology of online dating at the University of California, Berkeley. He teaches a university seminar called What Makes Us Click? The Sociology of Online Dating. He's also mentored individuals on online dating usage. Skylar, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, good to be back.
And Lisa Bonos is with us. She writes about relationships and dating at the Washington Post. Lisa, good to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start, Lisa, with you. And can you share some observations, things that you've seen changing in the dating world, online or not, since the pandemic began? What kind of things have you seen in your own reporting?
Yeah, the biggest change is that people are waiting a lot longer to meet up in person. They are either having phone calls or video dates before meeting up in person because that's safer. Whereas before, I think, like, if you, in February, if you would have asked somebody, like, would you like to go on a FaceTime date before an actual date, it'd be unlikely that the other person would say yes. So that's the biggest change right now.
Are people maybe more likely to try a first date? You can throw that in quotes if you want, Lisa, if they don't have to make that time commitment of going to a place and showing up.
I mean, it's still a little awkward to do a video date. People are saying it's not as awkward as they thought it would be, but I am also hearing from a lot of daters who are definitely not interested in doing it. So it's not a shoo-in that somebody wants to be video dating right now. And you also think about how much time we're already spending on video, but it is easier when you actually go on the date, right? You only have to look nice from the waist up. You don't have to go anywhere other than your couch. You don't have to pay for anyone other than yourself. And then when you go home, it's just, you just are already home. So it can be easier, but it doesn't mean everybody wants to do it.
And Skylar, what are some things you're seeing change over the last 6 months in the online dating world?
Yeah, I think in general, you know, there's a sort of motivational expansion that's going on. I think people are dating for more reasons now. It's not really just, you know, people are looking for serious relationships. There's a lot more talk about just finding companionship just to weather through COVID, you know. So I think, you know, there's an expansion of what is to be expected, an expansion of different possibilities and different desires. I'm also noticing that a lot of people who were previously hesitant or resistant to online dating are actually flocking to dating apps and dating sites. A lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, if these people previously had stigmatized views on online dating, now it's not really something that they can really think about anymore, just because, you know, you can't go to the bars, you can't go to the restaurants to meet people organically anymore. So everyone has to go online to date. And also, you know, the whole like, oh, I don't want to tell people that we met online kind of a thing doesn't really matter anymore, because, you know, it's not that embarrassing to say we met through Tinder during COVID, because that's the only available way for people to date nowadays.
Now, Skylar, I think people are faced with a paradox of choice, whether they're in a cereal aisle or on an online dating website, this thought that, you know, I've got the whole world in front of me on my screen, potentially. How am I going to find the right perfect person? Are people more willing to, I don't know, I don't want to use the word settle, but I'll say settle in hopes of finding that that companionship that they're really desperate for during COVID?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the million-dollar question. And, you know, that's a question I'm trying to figure out in my own research as well. You know, dating in the past used to be a lot simpler in the sense that you had access to your immediate networks, right? You were dating people in your neighborhoods, you were dating people you were working with or you went to school with. But now, you know, with online dating, distance isn't the problem anymore. You have access to a lot more people, right? So that paradox of choice question is definitely something that a lot of online daters are having to deal with. And, you know, when it comes to settling, you know, during COVID, I think a lot of people have basically expanded their criteria. And a lot of people have done so pretty dramatically. You know, if they weren't okay with dating a certain type of people before, you know, now with COVID, they tend to be a lot more open-minded. You know, I have clients and I have friends who are dating people who are not even in the US. That's something that they weren't even thinking about before COVID. But now, you know, I have a friend who's in this long distance relationship with a guy in Brazil, and they seem to be doing really well. So, yeah.
We were talking about dating online and maybe even in person during the COVID-19 pandemic. We have Skylar Wang with us from the University of California, Berkeley, Lisa Bonos from The Washington Post, and you, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234. If you are in the dating world right now yourself, love to hear your story of how you're trying to manage this, or if someone close to you is, maybe a kid, a loved one, a parent, call in, share how it's going. 800-642-1234. Lisa, there's a lot of milestones in relationships, you know, a first date, meeting family, whatever. Now there's this milestone that I don't think people thought about before. Am I ready to introduce this person in my circle of possible disease transmission? How are people juggling this?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to one dater in Washington, D.C., who before she went on a first date, asked her roommates, she lives in a group house with several other people, if it was okay to kiss her date if it was going well. And, you know, that's not normally something that people would discuss ahead of time. You know, people are adding partners to their bubbles, that sort of thing. I mean, I think there's also all kinds of milestones, right? I'm seeing someone and he at one point gave me a face shield that he had bought a bunch of face shields and I was going to be getting on a flight and he was, you know, said that he was going to give me one.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm like, I think PPE has become the new bouquet of flowers
Wow. Okay. Skylar, how are you seeing people? Lisa had mentioned earlier, maybe a little more conversation online. Like, we've got this automatic icebreaker now. I've seen people talking about this. Oh, it's your job, your education, whatever. And now it's, you know, there's something built in to talk about. How are you seeing those first conversations for the people you work with who do online dating?
Yeah, I think, you know, for a lot of people, especially heterosexual men, you know, all of a sudden they're finding that they need to put in a lot more effort into, you know, crafting meaningful messages now. Just because, you know, pre-COVID, the idea is to, you know, just have one or two sort of openers and then set something up quickly and then go meet in person. But now, you know, because of how prolonged the virtual part of it is going to be, and so people are putting a lot more effort, and it's definitely challenging, you know, for a lot of people around me. You know, they're finding it hard to find interesting things to talk about, even when they're doing virtual dating. You know, it's like you're just staring at a person. Like, you know, that's why I always tell them, you know, don't just, like, even when you're like dating offline, dating pre-COVID, you're not just like sitting at a restaurant and having wine and just like staring at the person's face, right? You're sort of like talking about the food. You're sort of sharing a common experience, which is why I say, you know, when you're doing a virtual date, you know, maybe watch a movie together or play a game, you know, an online game or something, because through this shared activity, you can basically assess compatibility and chemistry. So there are like definitely creative ways to strike up, you know, a good conversation and find meaningful activities to you know, make your dating experience more fun.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us in Dubuque. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I was curious as to when you guys are talking about the social distancing dating, doing the FaceTime dating, what age group are you technically talking about? I am a 25-something-year-old. I'm married. My other girlfriends are all single, and I feel like they're dating more now because of COVID. People are still doing the FaceTime dates. That's after they met somebody in person to see if they really connect. I mean, they social distance and stuff. Like, oh, the person I'm talking to, they haven't been around a whole lot of people, so they're safe. But at the same time, I feel like people are dating more right now. I'm just a little curious as to, like, the age frame you're looking at.
Interesting, Elizabeth. Thanks for sharing the example from your circle of friends. Lisa, do you see differences by age in how people are managing dating during COVID?
Not especially. I mean, it sort of depends on what someone's living situation is right now, I think, right? Like, I generally speak to daters, you know, from their 20s to their 60s is kind of what the conversations I've been having recently. And, you know, some people in that age range might be living with parents who are high risk, or their children are around, and so they don't have a lot of privacy. So I'm seeing all sorts of things, but generally the FaceTime dates are happening before the social distanced dates in person, if that's what she was asking about as well.
And Skylar, once upon a time, I think the stereotype of online dating would have been younger people and younger people only. I'm guessing that hasn't been true for some years now. What are you seeing now when it comes to the age breakdown of people going online and dating?
Yeah, I think there's an uptick in all demographics, really. A lot of, you know, young people, old people, they're all online dating. But I would say that, yes, the sort of main demographics would still be sort of young adults, you know, people between the age of 18 to about 34. A lot of them are sort of, if you're looking at proportions, you know, a lot of them are trying online dating. A lot of them are in relationships with partners that they found online. And there are more marriages that are happening in this age group as well. And so, yeah, so, you know, the sort of trend that the listener, also the caller, identified is certainly accurate. I think a lot of younger people are actually going on, you know, these in-person socially distanced dates. But it does depend so much on the state you're in, the country you're in, your living situation. But I would say, yeah, in general, younger people's risk factors are lower than people who are older. So they're more willing to go out and potentially expose themselves.
We're talking about dating during the pandemic. Skylar Wang is with us from University of California, Berkeley. Lisa Bonos, columnist on relationships and dating at The Washington Post. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What has your dating experience been like, if any, in the last few months? Have you been on any apps, on any in-person dates? How do you take the step from virtual to in-person with safe distancing? Call in at 800-642-1234. And do you think the pandemic has made you want maybe different things out of a relationship? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how the pandemic has impacted dating. Lisa Bonos is with us. She writes about relationships and dating for The Washington Post. Skylar Wang studies the sociology of online dating at the University of California, Berkeley. You can join in with your thoughts, questions, maybe experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Al is with us in Eau Claire. Al, hi.
Hi, how you doing? My experience, this is my wife and I met each other over 20 years ago when we first started our relationship. And this is like pre-MySpace. We were on the phone, and it was long distance. And tell you the truth, we got to know each other really well, just concentrating on each other, talking to each other, and getting to know each other without all the distractions of everything else, of the pub scenes or the club scenes or wherever you're at. I'm wondering, are the younger people now in this dating time, are they finding that experience as well, where they get that opportunity?
That's interesting. Al, thank you so much. And I imagine you're still paying off those phone bills if that was 20 years ago. So Skylar, Al is saying, you know, he did it pre-computer a little bit, but found it really valuable to have those focused conversations without all the distractions. Are people online, especially maybe now when they only are having that, finding similar stories?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's just really hard to not be distracted, you know, when you're online dating, right? Because like I've said, you know, previously, you know, even like I've seen or I've, you know, talked to friends who are basically swiping during dates, right? They'll go on a date, maybe they'll take a bathroom break, and in the bathroom they're swiping away, right? So there's just so many, you know, ways to be distracted. And I do think that, you know, every generation, they feel like their love is perhaps more unique or more special than the generation that's sort of, you know, after theirs. And I think, but for me, you know, personally, I just feel like it's different, right? You know, we have different technologies. We have, you know, culturally right now, you know, how people meet each other is very different from how it used to be. And I don't know if one is good or one is bad, but, you know, I just think it's a different sort of social phenomenon that we're living through. But I would still say that, you know, a lot of people are finding very meaningful relationships, are finding partners, and fulfilling whatever they want to seek for.
Interesting. And Lisa, do you, as you reported this, do you find people making that value judgment like, oh, hey, this, you know, more time online before meeting is a good thing, a bad thing, or just different?
I don't know. I think they're just seeing this is the only option, right? This is the safest way to do it, is to talk online for a long time. I mean, one couple that stands out to me is a woman in Washington and a man who was living outside the area but was going to be moving to the Washington area. And they spoke over Skype or virtually every day for months before he did move nearby. And they then when they were, you know, able to see each other in person, neither of them has a car and they were both walking far distances to see each other. And so that is a lot of investment to put in someone that you haven't met yet. And that's kind of what's required to be dating right now and to eventually see someone in person. So I am seeing encouraging examples like that.
Let's go back to our callers. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. Two things to say, actually. I had a partner tell me that they would want to stay with me if the world ended because I was taking good care of a sourdough starter and I knew how to pickle and ferment a bunch of different vegetables. And that aside, I've heard heard people sort of idolize the way dating was done in the past, where, like, oh, it was more organic and you would meet in person and stuff. But, you know, I think our grandkids are going to lionize the way that we dated now in their past, because you always look back at your grandparents and think that, like, oh, that's the way it should have been done. But everyone does it different.
John, thanks a lot for the call. So, yeah, nostalgia sometimes maybe makes us think something different. But I love that idea about the sourdough there. Lisa, do you see people maybe changing what they value in a partner? Maybe it's a practical life skill like that, or something else that would make us think about settling down with this person in a tough time.
For sure, I think people are reevaluating what they're looking for in a partner and seeing the qualities that actually do matter, right? Is someone a good communicator? That's really important right now, because so many of us are essentially in long distance relationships, regardless of how far away we live from each other. And, you know, I'm reminded at the beginning of the pandemic of a friend who said that their grandparents met at a party during the 1918 flu. You know, I mean, we're now trying, you know, like someday, you know, we're kind of doing the same thing. You could meet someone at a picnic these days, right? And isn't that the same kind of meeting in very similar circumstances 100 years apart?
And Skylar, do you see, especially in the online world, actually people changing their priorities for what they're looking for in a potential partner?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think a lot of people are expanding, you know, like I said, their criteria pretty dramatically, I would say, simply because, you know, like Lisa said, you know, it doesn't matter if they're down the street or if they're, you know, all the way in Tokyo, right? Right now, everything is sort of long distance. So yeah, and also because, you know, more people are sort of, you know, looking for companionship rather than actual relationship formation as well. So people are taking their times, and so their own time to sort of get to know people. And perhaps, you know, there are a lot more friendships that come out of, you know, COVID dating rather than actual kind of formative relationships.
Lisa, in our last couple of minutes, do you see maybe some of what people are doing now when it comes to dating sticking around even after, and hopefully this comes soon, after we're not dealing with the worst of COVID-19?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, several daters have told me that they never want to go on a first date in person again, that the virtual thing is so much easier that they're just going to stick with that. It's hard to know what we will be doing, you know, in a year from now, but that was interesting to me. And I think, you know, the way that we're starting, daters are really getting to know each other on a deeper level before moving to the next stage of becoming physical or even meeting in person, that might stick around for a little while. Yeah.
And Skylar, can you hit us with some advice for someone who's maybe thinking about putting out their first profile or maybe updating it for the current era? What would you suggest to the aspiring online dater?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's really important to signal your hobbies and interests. That would be really helpful in terms of sort of just allowing someone to find a way to connect with you, not just, you know, so I was saying before, you know, talking to someone about who they are is a really difficult task, right? But it's a lot easier to experience something together, right? So if you're really into Code Names, which is a board game, you know, put that on your profile. You know, there are free versions that you can play with, you know, your friends or a potential date. Just be sort of really specific about what you like, what you enjoy doing in your free time. And that will help people sort of think about potential date ideas, different activities that you can do together. But yeah, and, you know, I encourage, you know, people who are able to go, you know, take a walk in a park, you know, with a potential date, do socially distancing, you know, activities outside. I think a lot of people are actually doing that right now and have been finding success.
We'll leave it there. Skylar, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Lisa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Skylar Wang is a PhD candidate who studies the sociology of online dating at the University of California, Berkeley. He teaches, by the way, a university seminar there called What Makes Us Click? The Sociology of Online Dating. And Lisa Bonos writes about relationships and dating. You could follow her work at The Washington Post. They join us today to talk about what it's like to date during the pandemic. Still time for you to share your experiences, maybe your suggestions for others, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow at 8, Kate and her guest take a big picture look at the latest news of the presidential race and how the Electoral College could sway the result no matter what the popular vote ends up looking like. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then historian Rick Perlstein joins the show with his latest look on at the rise of conservative politics in the 1960s and 70s. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.